From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. We focus the conversation today on two new reports. The first offers new data on the course-taking patterns of undergraduates in the humanities and STEM fields, suggesting that the concern about the demise of the humanities may be premature. The second report proclaims that, quote, the leadership of higher education is out of balance. It calls for trustees to, quote, take a more active role in reviewing and benchmarking the work of faculty and administrators and monitoring institutional outcomes, end quote. Hi, this is Casey Green, the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. Counting courses in the humanities and STEM fields. What data really matter in the campus and public policy conversations about undergraduate enrollments in the humanities versus STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics? Should the focus be on courses or on majors? This is the question that emerges from a new report issued this past week from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences about the course-taking patterns of undergraduates, and specifically the courses that humanities and STEM majors complete in other fields. The Academy's analysis is based on transcript data for a national cohort of students who completed undergraduate degrees in 2008. Not surprisingly, the data suggests that although students stay in academic silos. Somewhat surprisingly, however, is that STEM majors seem to take more humanities courses than humanities majors take STEM courses. And even then, STEM majors outnumber humanities majors undergraduates in aggregate for more credits in the humanities than in STEM fields. Joining us for this conversation are Carol Schneider, who is president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. Robert Thompson is the director of the Washington office of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and also directs the work on the Academy's Humanities Indicators Project. And Scott Jasek is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Rob Thompson, let me tune to you first. This is your report. We've had this conversation before about humanities versus STEM majors. What's new in this analysis and why should we pay attention to it?
I think from our perspective, there are kind of two key takeaways. One is just the siloed nature of higher education today, as we were kind of surprised just at how little overlap there was between the STEM fields as kind of defined here and the humanities. The other is simply that the number of majors a discipline or field has really doesn't tell the whole story about the role of the discipline in the ecosystem of higher ed. In this case, 12% of the students graduating from the nation's colleges and universities are in the humanities. Only, a full 17% of the coursework is in the humanities, and I think that was really a kind of a surprise to us just at that disparity. Even though I think a lot of administrators know how these numbers play out, I think we were thought it would be useful just to start a conversation and get this these numbers out to a wider set of the larger higher ed community.
Rob, I think a lot of folks might say, though, is some of that difference between majors versus courses a consequence of general ed requirements, that perhaps the general ed requirements are larger in the humanities than they are in the sciences?
Sure. And I think one of the other sort of questions we wanted to raise was simply why humanities majors, sort of looking back at ourselves, why are humanities majors taking so many fewer courses in STEM? And what does it say about the fact that in some ways you have to be forced to take a class in order to get somebody into it?
Well, Carol Schneider, let's talk a bit about the structure of some of those silos. General ed notwithstanding, it would seem that one of the barriers to entry, if you will, for humanities students who would like to take science courses is the structure of the disciplines and the fact that the STEM fields are more likely to have prerequisites than many of the humanities courses. Does that work as a significant disincentive?
Well, from our point of view, the big question is whether or not our students are actually getting a broad liberal education, and a broad liberal education by design needs to ensure that they acquire a lot of knowledge about the wider world, for which they need the humanities and the social sciences. And it also means that students need to have a working understanding of how science is done, the kind of evidence that science produces, and so on. That's the reason why we have general education courses. But from our point of view, the real issue that this report underscores is the missing third strand in undergraduate education. Because it isn't really more science or more humanities or more in the major. The real question is whether or not students can use perspectives from sciences and the humanities and their majors to actually solve problems that require multiple lenses for their solution.
Scott Jasek, as a reporter and as an editor, you're a longtime observer of these trends in higher education. What stands out for you in the new report from the Academy?
Well, I think the timing of this is really interesting because it could have a direct impact on a lot of policy debates going on. Since 2008, as a lot of colleges have been looking to eliminate programs, many have been making their choices in large part through analysis of majors. And a lot of humanities programs have been cut, and the cuts have been justified by saying, well, not that many people major in philosophy or French or whatever. And the counter to that has been, well, you're actually destroying Gen Ed if you don't have people who are experts in a range of fields. So this question of whether majors or enrollment are the best indicator of demand is a very relevant one right now.
We really need to keep our mind on the big picture, which is why do we want an educated citizenry? What is it they're supposed to do with their education? And it's true that we're, as Scott says, we're absolutely bogged down as a society in counting courses, counting majors, counting all kinds of things that lend themselves to easy metrics, when we really need to be asking how good are our students at evidence-based reasoning, using evidence from the sciences, using evidence from the humanities, using evidence from their own major if it's not in one of those zones.
Well, Carol Schneider, to that end, again, because the data show that, in fact, STEM students often take more humanities courses than humanities majors take STEM courses, many campuses, as you know, have these outreach courses, math for poets, if you will, that in part to bring students in and also, quite honestly, to build up enrollments in terms of whatever the internal payments might be to various departments. How effective are those outreach efforts in terms of bringing in humanities students to STEM courses?
Well, obviously it varies a lot in terms of what the courses are. We are very excited about work that's starting to emerge that really works students through complex cases. We have a set of faculty we call STIRS Scholars. STIRS is an acronym for Scientific Thinking and Integrative Reasoning. And they're developing cases that can be used within a course. You don't have to take a whole course on the case, but these could be modules for science courses, for social science and humanities courses. But they address big problems like people, places, and pipelines, cases that look at the Keystone pipeline analysis and look at it from the point of view of the science on the one hand, what are the likely effects on the environment, but the people on the other hand, people in this case include, among others, Native Indians and their concerns about their ancient tribal burial grounds. So the point of a case like this is to have a student do a scientific analysis, do a people analysis, do a cultural analysis, and make some recommendations that explicitly take the public good into account. And when you have that kind of really well thought through, detailed analysis using the science, but also engaging some of the bigger questions for which the humanities are absolutely essential, then you are more likely to have a student who emerges as a thoughtful citizen, whether or not he's a science major, capable of using complex reasoning on an important question.
Rob Thompson, one of the features that emerges for me from these data is the retention rate for students in various majors. We know that the STEM fields have lower retention rates in terms of freshman retention than other fields. That students encounter, and the interesting irony there is that if you look at the academic profile of students as entering freshmen for the STEM fields, often they have higher SAT scores, higher GPAs than their counterparts in some other areas. The STEM fields consequently have a higher attrition rate. Students who run into courses or run into other kinds of things in the environment that say, no, this doesn't work for me. Think about pre-med majors, for example, who encounter organic chemistry and self-select themselves out, not just of the pre-med path, but also of a science career. How does that affect some of these data in terms of course-taking patterns?
Well, you know, that's something we can't really track within this data set. It really just shows us, outcomes and shows us outcomes simply for students who had graduated in 2008. And some of that movement within the system, I think, is something that we as social scientists would really like to be able to track better. And one of the other bits of data that we can't really track is the number of students who are earning their credits at two-year colleges and then moving over or moving in and out of two- and four-year programs. And I think that's one of the challenges, just in terms of keeping track of what's often a moving target in these data. Just sort of what we can get is really just lumping everything down to what are the simple numbers of students coming out. And I think a lot of that movement is really a crucial area that requires a lot more study.
Scott Jassy, it seems to me that the elephant, Carol, if I may, Scott, it seems to me that the elephant in the room in this conversation, however, is undergraduate business majors, which account for about 20% of undergraduate degrees. Admittedly, you have a lot of older students majoring in business as opposed to STEM or the humanities fields. How does that play into some of this conversation? Certainly, we've seen this come into the public policy conversations about where colleges maybe should be adding or reducing programs.
Well, I think there's a lot of oversimplification today and sort of the assumption that, well, the path to good jobs is major in business or maybe major in STEM. What I think more knowledgeable people are putting forward, though, is the idea that, as Carol was saying, you need more people to have a knowledge base. If you look at the polls on the percentage of Americans who do not accept evolution, who do not accept climate change, it's a huge challenge to our society going forward that there are people who just don't have the basics. And in fact, I think the traditional, and I should say this, I took physics for poets to satisfy an old-style distribution requirement, but I couldn't tell you any physics today. And I think there is a sense that moving away from that and toward fields where you do need integrated knowledge will help the business major whose new business idea as likely or not is a STEM-related idea, the policymaker, and the pure scientist. The idea of silos isn't just a bad thing in higher ed, it's probably a bad thing in life.
Well, Tom, so let's talk a bit about the data in the context of patterns by campus types. Anything you could tell us that go beyond the majors to look at patterns by majors by different types of institutions in terms of, say, liberal arts colleges or four-year teaching institutions or research universities?
No, we didn't break the data down that way. Certainly in terms of the trends in majors, there is a shift towards comprehensive, sort of the major master's level colleges and universities becoming a growing sector for the humanities, and I think that's a trend that we're following with interest.
Carol Schneider, let's come back to the issue about recruiting humanities majors to STEM courses. What many might find interesting in the data, again, is that STEM majors were more likely to take humanities courses than humanities majors were to STEM courses. You talked a little bit about some approaches. Can you tell us a bit more about other ways to bring humanities majors into STEM courses?
Well, that brings us, of course, back to the way the different fields of study are organized. The STEM fields tend to be highly structured, and they have introductory prerequisites, and there's an expectation of following a path toward more sophisticated advanced learning. The humanities are more likely to have some kind of a foundational course and then a lot of different pathways, think of a tree branching out, rather than a long road that gets you finally to real work in science. But the important thing, and I think we need to focus on, is that thoughtful people, both in science fields and in the humanities, are really trying to change those progressions. If you just think for a minute about med school actually admits students to do some very important scientific work who were English majors or philosophy majors as undergraduates, and the MCAT has been broadened to challenge students to take more work in the humanities and the social sciences, all of that signaling a recognition by the professions, which is matched in business as well, that we need people who are both and, who are T-shaped graduates with depth in their fields and breadth in the humanities, social sciences, and other things that tell us about the complex world we're actually working in. So it's not so much do I get more students to translate from transfer from one major to another, but how do we redesign the whole pathway so that students are engaged from the beginning in seeing the big picture and the importance of science and the humanities to pretty much any problem we really want to solve.
And Rob Townsend, let me offer the last comment to you in terms of Carol's statement about thoughtful people. What do you hope the thoughtful people would do with the data from this report? A year from now or 2 years from now, what would you like to see to be the impact of this work?
Well, I think for us, it's really just to start this precise conversation. Actually, we'll be releasing today or tomorrow a new set of data about occupations, which clearly shows, to second Scott's earlier point, that those folks who are getting humanities majors, if they go on and get a second degree, they're much more likely to be spread across all occupational sectors, including the sciences, than, for instance, the sciences are to be in occupations that would be traditionally seen as more humanities-oriented, that they're really widely spread, and that in some ways we see the humanities as a field that prepares people for a wide range of careers, and I think that's what's really important here.
Great. My thanks to the three of you, to Carol Schneider at the Association of American Colleges and Universities, Robert Townsend in the Washington Office of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed for an engaging conversation. Trustees in Academic Reform. A report issued this week by ACTA, the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, an organization viewed by some campus observers as having a conservative agenda for higher education, calls for active trustee engagement in academic governance for a new era. The report cites, quote, the failure of higher education governance, quote, is a contributing factor affecting both the much-discussed rising costs and declining quality of American colleges and universities. Quote, the leadership of higher education is out of balance, quote, says the ACTA report, which proclaims that, quote, trustees should take a more active role in reviewing and benchmarking the work of faculty and administrators and monitoring outcomes, end quote. Joining us for this conversation are Benno Schmidt, the former president of Yale University, who is the chairperson of the board of City University of New York. He also chaired the panel that produced the report, Governance for a New Era for ACTA. Henry Ruckman is a professor emeritus of history at California State University, East Bay, and is also currently the first vice president of the American Association of University Professors and chairs AAUP's Committee A on Academic Freedom and Tenure. And Scott Jasek is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Benno Schmidt, let me turn to you for the opening question, and that is, why this report and why now? Many of the critiques of higher education cited in the report about academic quality, rising costs, institutional governance, and trustee engagement are not new. What makes this call for trustee engagement different from past calls?
Well, I think what is new in the criticism, first, this is not an ACTA report. This is a report by me and the other 22 signatories. ACTA simply facilitated this. This is not their position. This is the people who, my position and the people who signed the report.
But if I may, ACTA strongly supports the positioning. Is that they're assisting with distribution?
I don't know. I don't know if my views and that are expressed here are entirely in line with ACTA's or not. I don't think they are, but you would have to ask ACTA about
okay.
What is in the criticisms is the focus recently on whether colleges and universities are providing adequate learning outcomes for students, even the students who stay and get diplomas. President Obama has been active in criticizing that, among other things, his plan to grade colleges and universities. And so I think the criticism is higher than it's been in a long time, and includes the President of the United States, which is uncommon. And then my role at CUNY has taught me that for some reforms, the trustees really have to play a very active role alongside the faculty and the academic leadership. So that's why now. That's why the report comes now.
Scott Jasek, you've been a longtime observer of these kinds of reports. What differentiates this report from others?
Well, actually, what I think is interesting is the timing. in that we're in a period where we've seen a number of cases, say the University of Virginia, where they tried to oust the president 2 years ago, the University of Texas at Austin, where they tried to do the same, College of Charleston, where board members sort of imposed a choice for president. While this report is calling for trustees to be more involved in things including presidential selection and evaluation, we've seen a number of prominent campuses divided over trustees doing just that. And it raises questions. And so to me, it's an interesting time when you have a lot of faculty and alumni saying trustees are going too far, to have a group coming out and saying, generally, we see trustees not going far enough.
Well, Hank Reichman, AAUP was strongly supportive of the president at Virginia. I'm assuming also supportive of the president at UT Austin. In this context, are these examples of overreach?
I think they are, and I think that there are a number of things in this report that are highly debatable, and some that I actually agree with, like their position on athletics and the position against using search firms for hiring presidents. I'd extend that down the administrative hierarchy as well. But I think there are they call for trustee engagement, which I actually think is a kind of interventionist call, is at best unrealistic. When we have seen trustee engagement and trustee intervention, it's generally been for the negative. I would add to your examples the case of the Board of Regents of the University of Kansas, who crafted a social media policy that was widely condemned, not just by faculty, but by civil liberties groups, by the general public, as a complete violation of not only academic freedom, but really of First Amendment rights.
Let's turn to some of the specifics in the report. One part of the report talks about academic diversity, offering some strong statements. Trustees should demand action if they believe a department places limitations on the representation of disciplinary fields and academic viewpoints in its research and teaching. The president and provost must be prepared to explain how they will ensure intellectual and pedagogical diversity going forward. How would institutions measure this? And how do you measure it in very diverse departments such as biology, mathematics, philosophy, political science, and economics?
Well, I think trustee action in this area would be exceedingly rare and would only come about in quite extreme situations. With respect to academic diversity, as with respect to everything else, this is not a report that calls for unilateral trustee action. It's a report that assumes that trustees act through the campus leaders and the academic leaders, and that matters, where it's appropriate, matters would go first to the faculty, and we would get the faculty's point of view on the matter, and then it would go, if it comes to the trustees, it would be at the recommendation of the campus president or chancellor or provost. So the academic diversity point would be a very rare situation, which would come up only in very extreme cases and would come out of the academic leadership of the institution before it got to the trustees.
Hey, Craig, well, let's turn to another one of the recommendations, and this is adding or terminating academic programs. The report states that, quote, data from the National Science Foundation on the income of graduates in particular majors can provide significant insights for prioritizing academics programs. At face value, this recommendation would seem to give two thumbs up to areas such as business, computer science, and engineering that are driven by markets, and other majors that might be supportive of an institutional mission, such as anthropology, philosophy, classics, and Portuguese, might get less support or potentially be on the cutting block.
Well, I think that is the danger, that, in fact, trustees have done that, and indeed I cannot agree with Benno's statement that this would be very rare, because in fact it's actually increasingly common that trustees are intervening in curricular decisions, and in particular in using excuses of financial hardship to eliminate programs that they believe are either unprofitable or don't really work. And it's generally been humanities programs and social science programs at the expense of business and the hard sciences. Moreover, President Schmidt mentioned that this should be done in cooperation with the faculty. But in fact, at his own City University, the trustees pushed forward a new so-called reform of general education, which I believe runs counter to the commitment to general education we read about in the report, which was opposed in a vote by 94% of the faculty of the CUNY system as something that basically stripped down and dumbed down the general education program at CUNY.
Scott Jasek, again, you're an observer of this and a longtime observer in terms of the context of the conversation about academic diversity, one of the core recommendations, the issue of adding or terminating programs based on the NSF data. What do you see happening in this environment?
I mean, I actually see a lot of colleges and universities doing just what this report recommends, but there are a lot of people who think it's very short-sighted, that we definitely have a problem in American society with STEM majors and so forth, but that problem actually arguably is a sixth grade problem where students aren't taking the math and science to prepare themselves to do more STEM. And there's very little evidence that eliminating humanities programs will help our STEM programs. There's also the question of the traditional division between this sort of academic side of the house and the financial administrative side of the house, and the question of who should look at the curriculum and say, what do we need, what relates, as this report suggests, to the mission of this institution. So I actually don't see evidence of the problem cited in the report that trustees aren't paying attention to job outcomes. I think they're very focused on that these days.
May I just kind of give two quick examples? At my own institution, California State University, we have a graduation requirement in U.S. History and Constitution, which has been there since the 1970s, and something that I think the report would applaud. In fact, we had a major system-wide planning effort. I was one of seven faculty members who participated. It was trustees there that kept arguing that we should eliminate that requirement because, well, they take it in high school, and we should have more career-oriented courses. And fortunately, the faculty resisted this. And similarly, also at San Jose State University, right near me, in the 1990s, they had huge growth in computer science, and at the expense of enrollment in humanities programs. One of the problems they faced was that computer science was a highly expensive program, and they needed to balance it with enrollment growth in less expensive programs. It's a good thing they did, too, because a decade later, computer science collapsed, and suddenly they had excess faculty, excess resources in computer science.
Now, Schmidt, I want to talk a bit about the public politics of public institutions and board appointments. Certainly, the report states about two-thirds of states' appointments to public boards and four-year colleges and universities come through the governor's office. Many observers would say these appointments seem to be increasingly politicized. We have a situation in Texas right now where a political appointment to the board by the governor was recently censured by a committee of the legislature. Where does this all play out in terms of board engagement if these appointments become increasingly politicized because of the political process of appointments?
Well, I would argue that governors should make initial appointments, but they should be for longer terms, as is true on the CUNY board, so that individual trustees serve beyond a governor's term in most cases, and don't see themselves as really representing the political interests of the governor, but rather the interests of the public of the state, insofar as the trustees see what that is. So I would argue for longer terms to ensure that trustees don't just represent particular governor's political points of view. And in many states, that's the way it works.
Well, related to the appointment process, the board also recommends independent, frequent and independent training for the boards. What constitutes independent training? Hank Reichman, you might have a view on that that's very different than the view that Benner Schmidt has. What would you view to be independent training, Hank Reichman?
Well, I think independent training would be training by different organizations that are not just simply the administration. I know many boards are simply trained by their administration to do what the administration wants them to do, and I think that's something that Benno and I both would probably agree is not very constructive. I would love to see boards have AAUP people come in and educate them about the principles of academic freedom. But I do think that it may be unrealistic to assume that this could really fundamentally change the way boards function. I think that whether we like it or not, and including in places like my system where there are long-term trustee appointments, the appointments are still highly politicized. I was nominated by the faculty of the California State System to be a faculty trustee. We have one on the board. Governor Schwarzenegger, then Governor Schwarzenegger, refused to appoint either of the two candidates that were nominated for that position, and the position was left vacant for several years. So, and it was a highly political decision. We were both Democrats, and he was a Republican.
Now, sure, let me turn to you in terms of the board. The recommendations in this report would seem to put more burden on trustees in terms of their engagement and time. Spending time on campus, more time looking at documents, and greater costs for campuses in terms of preparing materials and additional data for trustees. Is that a fair assessment? And if so, what does that mean in terms of the trustee commitment or obligation to serve?
Well, I think that is a fair assessment. I think trustees need to have access to much more information than they currently tend to get, particularly information about student learning outcomes. And I think that will require more time and probably will require more effort by the campus to develop materials for trustees. But I think the trustees of higher education institutions, these are vitally important institutions for our society. And to be a trustee is a very, very important responsibility. I mean, one ought to take the time that it takes to try to do the job in a well-informed way.
Scott, let me turn to you with the last question. So we see lots of these reports, whether they come from panels like this one, from various organizations, the DuPont Circle groups or federal agencies. What's the legacy of this report? Is this another one that gets sort of flares and then dissipates, or does this one have a legacy and does it have legs?
It's probably too early to say, but what I would say is reports that have been distributed by ACTA, which is, I believe, distributing this one, sometimes are derided in the sort of mainstream academic groups, but there's a lot of evidence that there are a lot of trustees, particularly appointed by more conservative legislators, who are reading and acting on these reports. If you look at some of the email in the UVA case that came out, it seems pretty clear that there is an audience for this report, and whether professors or presidents agree with it or not, I suspect it'll be read by a lot of trustees.
Great. My thanks to all of you for the informative conversation about trustee engagement. Thank you for joining us this week, and our thanks to the four individuals who aided and informed our conversations: Carol Schneider, the president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities; Rob Townsend, director of the Washington office of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences; Benno Schmidt, former president of Yale University and the chairperson of the board, City University of New York; and Hank Reichman, professor emeritus of history at California State University, East Bay, and also the first vice president of AAUP and chair of AAUP's Committee A on Academic Freedom and Tenure. And of course, we want to acknowledge Scott Jasek, who is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about This Week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for this week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.